Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone. It's a beautiful day here in Iowa. Glad for that. The rain seems to be gone away for a little while, so that's good. I hope everything's good wherever you are.
We've been dealing with a lot of rain, and there's flooding in parts of Iowa. There was some flooding in my basement, which I'm not too happy about.
And oh, no.
Yeah.
We have it. I'm in New Orleans. We're having a huge storm right now, so I'm hoping if it starts pouring in New Orleans, I think you'll be able to hear it because it's that loud.
Wow. So today we have a first-time published novelist, not a first-time writer, as we'll talk about soon, Samantha Downing. And the title of her book is My Lovely Wife. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Samantha.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So, in your online, on your website, SamanthaDowning.com, you talk about having written quite a bit before My Lovely Wife got published. You want to tell us a little bit about your background as a writer?
Sure. I started writing as a hobby, really, about 20 years ago. I think the timing probably had something to do with getting my first personal computer at home. I don't know that I didn't much writing before that, but I started doing it, and I just liked it as a hobby. That's why I continued for so long. I went to a writing conference, and the publishing world just seemed impossible, and it was this crazy labyrinth that you practically needed a degree to understand. So I just said, you know what, I just want to write, so that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to worry about making a living with it. I'll have another job, and I'll just write. So I did, and that was my thing for 20 years, and now I'm published. And it was a fluke. It was all just a fluke.
Well, while you were writing all those 20 years, did you have a writer's group? Did you have somebody reading your work, or was it all just going straight into a drawer?
At times I had friends reading it. At times nobody was reading it. And then about 3 years ago, I did join a writer's group, and that's what changed everything. My writing would have progressed a lot faster if I had been in an official writing group, or a good writing group anyway.
Interesting. So tell us a little bit about this fluke.
This was a woman in my writer's group. She's still in my writer's group. Her name is Rebecca Vonier, and she is also a writer, but she loved this book, and I had started another one, and she said, no, I think this is the one that needs to be published. And she said, I know somebody, the infamous I know somebody. And so she knew a guy who went to school with.
She knew a guy who
someone,
knew a guy. Who...
exactly, who went to school with somebody who became an agent in New York, and she sent it. And I didn't send it to any, I didn't, she sent it to him, and he sent it to his friend in New York, and the agent contacted me and said, this is not really my thing. I only really represent nonfiction, but I know somebody. And back again to the know somebody. I know somebody who would be interested, and he referred me to Barbara Powell, who is now my agent, and she sold the book in 48 hours.
Wow.
So it was the 20-year overnight success.
So, Samantha, why do you think this book is the one that grabbed the attention of people?
I think a couple reasons. This one, it's a thriller, first and foremost, which is one of the top genres in the country, I'm sure, if not the world. It's a very straightforward domestic thriller in terms of genre, and that genre is very, very popular and very in demand. This book in particular, I think people can relate to the couple in a lot of ways. It does poke a little bit of fun at contemporary suburban life, and it has a little social commentary in there. So I think on one side of it, people really recognize what they're reading and recognize some of the conversations that the couple has. And that seems to be, from the feedback I get, this resonates with people. They understand at some level who Millicent is, and then they have this whole other dark side to them that people don't relate to. And then that's where the thriller part comes in.
Or maybe more people relate to it than we realize.
Yes. Well, that would be scary, right?
Yeah.
Yes, it would.
Samantha, this is a really, really dark, twisted story. I don't think I'm giving too much away by saying that.
No. No, it is. It definitely is. It's meant to be dark and disturbing.
So, first, was your earlier writing, did you write books in the same thriller vein, or was this a new thing for you?
I've gone through a number of genres. I think the original books I wrote were more sort of coming of age in the 20-something years. I think every writer writes those, and sometimes they get published, sometimes it just becomes the book that ends up in the drawer. But you kind of have to, or a lot of writers at least, I think, have to get their personal stuff out, and it may or may not be the stuff that gets published. And then from there, I started jumping around different genres. I tried literary. I tried horror. I've written a number of books in horror, but I sort of kept coming back to a thriller, but also a dark comedy. And that's really how I think of it. It's not just a thriller, but it's a very dark comedy.
It is a very dark comedy, and of course that seems to be, like you say, a popular genre right now. The thriller and the dark, disturbing things, coupled with a bit of dark comedy. One of my favorite movies from the past that is in that vein was Fargo. It was so disturbing and so funny at the same time, and I was just telling Mom about some of the two TV shows right now that are basically serial killer / assassins and comedies, which of course are Dexter, which your book has been compared to, and Barry. And why do you think people like to, like these characters or enough to want to watch them week after week or to read a whole book? What is it about that?
There's probably a couple reasons, I think. One is seeing something that you don't experience. Most people do not kill people. Most people will, unless you are a police officer, will never see a dead body. You will never be standing right in front of a dead body for most people, and nor would you ever be trying to solve that crime. So there is a fantasy element to thrillers that have crimes in them and people who are being pursued by the police or maybe not pursued by the police. I think in the case of Dexter, certainly he was, the core of that show was that he was killing people that were worse than him. So people could, it's kind of the only way he was an anti-hero, but he was also getting rid of people that most people didn't have a lot of sympathy for anyway. They were terrible people, and even so, as long as he didn't kill good people, it was justified in his mind as more of a vigilante type of a thing. So I think in that case, there has to be, if you're going to have an anti-hero that's so dark, they're either pure evil or they have to have something that balances them. And in the case of My Lovely Wife, they are parents, and Millicent is a mother, and I think that's actually what people find most disturbing about her. We've seen female serial killers before. They've been on TV, in the movies, in real life. I don't know that there's ever been one that's also a mother. So that seems to be something that sticks with people.
Well, I'm when you said that, I realized that's the Americans too. You have the couple who were Russian spies doing terrible, terrible things, but they were good parents and they love their kids, and you saw them in the day to day, and
exactly,
and you had to sympathize with them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so it's a is that like you can relate to them, but then they have this exciting, crazy life. You probably have most people at least have a very normal job that isn't nearly as exciting as what these people do, whether it be the Americans and their spying or Millicent and her husband in the book.
I mean, I couldn't put it down because I wanted to know what was going to happen next. And that's the idea.
That's what the best thing you can do as an author is make people keep turning the pages and want to know what happens next.
Okay, I was wondering if writing this, if you ever got depressed or, you know, anything, because it really is a page turner in everything, but there's some, you know, bad stuff in it.
Disturbing.
There is. Yeah.
Disturbing, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that when I'm writing, I sort of just shut down the emotions of it. So I can sort of channel the narrator that I'm working with, but I see it from his point of view. And if it's not disturbing to him, it's not disturbing to me. I try not to step out of it and look at it as Samantha. I just look at it through his point of view. So I guess for me, it doesn't get too disturbing.
Do you like reading this type of book? You know, the dark thriller?
Definitely. It's definitely what I grew up reading. My whole family read thrillers. They were always all over the house. So it's been the genre that I'm most familiar with throughout time. And now, I mean, that's what kind of happens as a writer is I'm writing the things that I want to read.
I bet you read Flowers in the Attic.
Yes, I did. I remember that.
My daughter read that whole series, and I used to think, why is she reading this stuff? But she loved it when she was like 13, 14, 15 years old.
It was so, you don't even realize how dark it is. You do, but you don't because it's just so creepy. You can't stop reading.
You know, that is something. We have a book that we're doing an interview on in a month or so called Ghost Stories, which is classic horror and suspense from Edgar Allan Poe, Charles Dickens, Mark Twain has one in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that readers have been drawn to being scared or being disturbed for as long as writers have been writing, I think. And writers have been drawn to writing these things.
Absolutely. I think that psychiatrists or whoever it is that determines these things have said that fear is the most potent human emotion that we have. It's the fear of dying, it's what keeps us alive. So I think that fear is what gets our adrenaline pumping, it gets the blood pumping, it's exciting to be scared. And some people very much don't like it because it's upsetting, but fear is a really potent emotion.
Definitely.
Well, you know, something interesting, back in the, 40s and 50s, there were lots of horror movies. I mean, you got the Draculas and,
Frankenstein.
You know, the Wolfman. And yeah, all those. And we went, my friends and I went to all of them. Frankenstein, and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Creature from the Black Lagoon. And we just interviewed the author of the book about the designer of the lady from, it was actually designed by a woman. The creature.
Ah.
Yeah, yeah. And her name was Millicent.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That is so funny.
Yeah, Millicent Patrick was the designer of the Creature from the Black Lagoon, but she got completely written out of history until now. So,
oh my goodness,
yeah.
I had no idea.
And I know.
I remember watching even on TV all the old Abbott and Costello movies, and there were so many funny ones from back then.
Yeah, yeah, the Abbott and Costello and the Wolfman, and in
mm-hmm.
fact, Millicent Patrick worked on some of those movies too. So that's all in this book, The Lady from the Black Lagoon.
I have to read
that whole history. Yeah, yeah. So, is it unusual? Do you think it's unusual, or do people think, well, you know, for a woman to be writing this horrible stuff, there must be something wrong with her.
Probably. But that's okay, you know.
Well, I know one time years ago I had written a fairly dark short story, and I gave it to a guy that I had just started dating to read, and he, like, it freaked him out. He's like, who is this person who would write this?
It's good for them to be freaked out sometimes.
Sometimes it is, and that was 20-some years ago, and we're still best of friends, so...
There you go. He wasn't too disturbed then.
He wasn't too disturbed. That's true. Now, I understand that the idea for My Lovely Wife was inspired by a true event.
Yes, there was a crime in the 70s. Colleen Stan was a woman who was kidnapped by a couple, and she was held captive for many years. And I saw a documentary about this, and I just thought, how can a woman do this? I mean, this is crazy. How would she help her husband? Because he was the one who really wanted to do it, and he convinced her to do it. And it was a very sad situation for her. She was a battered wife. She hadn't even finished high school. She really had nowhere to go. She went along with it. But she eventually actually let Colleen Stan go, and she testified against her husband, which is more what we expect of a woman. That's what we're used to more hearing, is a woman that does that, as opposed to something like kidnapping the woman in the first place. But it made me think, if a woman did do this, and if a woman was the instigator of it, who would the woman be? So my answer to my own question was Millicent. And I sort of just wanted to look at the crime, look at that kind of a crime, but flip-flopping the genders of the people.
Right. Now, there have been other cases more recently, too, where a wife was involved in some kidnapping or terrible thing. I'm thinking, wasn't there a wife in the Elizabeth Smart case, too?
Yes, I think that man was, he had sort of a little cult going on, and he had a wife, and I think there were other, I don't know if there were other girls or other women, but yes, there was definitely, and she's now out of jail. She just got out of jail.
Oh, wow. Wow. So when you were developing the character of Millicent, did you do a lot of study of these women who've been, you know, been in this, who've done these things?
I looked into some of the crimes. I did not look at them from what women had done. I looked at them from what men had done, mm-hmm. and tried to think, and then tried to come up with my own character for it. I didn't want to be too influenced by real events. I
right.
wanted to really come up with a character that doesn't really exist, that, or that we know of doesn't exist.
Wow.
That's probably best. That's probably the better way to do it, I would say.
Right. Yeah.
Millicent really became sort of an extreme superwoman type. She does everything that women are expected to do, the career, the wife, the kids.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She plays all the roles, and she takes all the roles to the extreme. So she's almost a parody of that type of thing. She's with her rules and the way she runs the household and the way they have their family dinners. I mean, it's almost an extreme of what's even possible these days with kids.
That is true. And she cooks every night, puts supper
mm-hmm.
on the table.
Mm-hmm. And somehow she gets the kids to agree not to have their cell phones at the table, and I don't know that any kid would agree to that for very long these days.
Yeah, my kids were grown before cell phones existed, and or at least were common. I think I had one when they were young, but the kids didn't have them yet. And my grandkids aren't old enough yet. The oldest one's 9, so I'm guessing it's not too long before he's
mm-hmm.
going to want his own phone. They do have their iPads, though, and it's hard to get them away from those.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Samantha, why don't you read us a little bit from My Lovely Wife?
Okay. The part I chose is, it's not the first chapter. The first first chapter is available online if anybody wants to read it, but I wanted to pick a chapter that was just between Millicent and her husband and the family, as opposed to the killing, so you can sort of see what the setup is here for them.
Great.
So this is from chapter 2. She gets up before I do. By the time I walk into the kitchen, Millicent is organizing breakfast, school lunches, the day, our lives. I know I should tell her about Petra. Not about the sex. I wouldn't tell my wife about that. But I should tell her that I made a mistake and that Petra is right for us. I should do it because it's a risk to leave Petra out there. Instead, I say nothing. Millicent looks at me, her disappointment hitting like a physical force. Her eyes are green, many shades of green, and they look like camouflage. They are nothing like Petra's. Millicent and Petra have nothing in common except they both slept with me, or some version of me. The kids tumble down the stairs, already yelling at each other, fighting over who said what about so-and-so at school yesterday. They are dressed and ready for school, just as I am dressed and ready for work in my tennis whites. I am not, and never have been, an accountant. While my kids are in school and my wife is selling houses, I am outside on the court, in the sun, teaching people how to play tennis. Most of my clients are middle-aged and out of shape, with too much money and time. Occasionally, I am hired by parents who believe their child is a prodigy, a champion, a future role model. So far, they have all been wrong. But before I can leave to teach anyone anything, Millicent makes us all sit together for at least 5 minutes. She calls it breakfast. Jenna rolls her eyes, taps her feet, anxious to get her phone back. No phones are allowed at the table. Rory is calmer than his sister. He makes the most of his 5 minutes by eating as much as possible, then stuffing his pockets with whatever doesn't fit in his mouth. Millicent sits across from me, a cup of coffee perched at her lips. She is dressed for work in a skirt, blouse, heels, and her red hair is pulled back. The morning sun makes it look like copper. We are the same age, but she looks better, always has. She is the woman I should not have been able to get. My daughter taps my arm in a pattern, like the beat to a song, and she continues until I pay attention to her. Jenna does not look like her mother. Her eyes, her hair, and the shape of her face come from me, and sometimes this makes me sad, other times not. Dad, can you take me to get new shoes today, she says. She is smiling because she knows I will say yes. Yes, I say. Millicent kicks me under the table. Those shoes are a month old, she says to Jenna. But they're too tight now. Not even my wife can argue with that. Rory asks if he can go play his video game for a few minutes before school. No, Millicent says. He looks at me. I should say no, but now I can't. Not after I said yes to his sister. He knows this because Rory is the smart one. He is also the one who looks like Millicent. Go ahead, I say. He races off. Millicent slams down her coffee cup. Jenna picks up her phone. We are done with breakfast. So just a glimpse into a normal little family breakfast there.
Yeah.
It's interesting how she could manage, a job and the family and everything and still have this second life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what's so interesting about it, I think.
And probably not possible for most normal human beings.
Right.
No, probably not.
So, Samantha, there's the character, the narrator says something about not being an accountant. And that, of course, is referring back to the previous chapter when he is pretending to be someone he's not. And
yes, and
that is a different name, Tobias, and he's an accountant. And he's deaf.
Yeah.
Now, and he's trying to pick up women in a bar as a deaf man.
Mm-hmm.
Why did
that's
you?
An interesting.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
And why did you choose to have him play that character? What was the thought process? How'd you come up with that idea?
One, I think that the pretending to be deaf has become a lot easier with cell phones and smartphones because you can text what you want to say and you don't have to write it down and you don't have to try to hand signal it to people who don't know sign language. So you feasibly could go into a bar and talk to a stranger just by using your cell phone. And it also evokes a sympathy, especially in females, that you feel bad. And he kind of goes through this in the first chapter. He knows she's not going to walk away when he picks up on her, because she doesn't want him to think it's because he's deaf. Mm-hmm. It may not be because he's deaf, but she doesn't want him to think it's that she would walk away from a man just because he was hearing impaired. So he knows he's kind of using that sympathy angle of it that women would have typically towards someone that they would feel an extra amount of sympathy for, whether they need it or not. It's just something that most women would do.
So it increases his odds of success.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there are men out there who actually do that?
There are definitely serial killers who do it, because I don't know about the deaf part, but Ted Bundy was famous for pretending he had a broken arm and asking a woman for help, and that's how he would capture them. So he would go into an empty parking lot and pretend he needed help putting the key in the door of his car. Can you please help me? And of course a woman would help, and then he would push her into the car. So now, of course, you can't do that because we all have little buttons that unlock our car.
Yeah.
You don't need that. They put the key in. But it's very common for, from what I understand, serial killers like a Ted Bundy would figure out pretty quick that if you need help, a woman will probably help you.
Wow. Well, there's another example of, there's a documentary or about Ted Bundy that came out recently, and again, people seem to be drawn to watching that. I didn't want to watch it because I don't want to know more about him. And also, there was some controversy because he was painted maybe more sympathetically than people thought he should have been.
I haven't watched it yet. I know it just came out. There's a couple things I know about Ted Bundy. One, and I believe it was from someone who knew him, said that a lot of the things about Ted Bundy that are out there are more legend than they are truth, and that he was a raging alcoholic, and a lot of the murders he did, very drunk. He blacked out, and it would not be possible for him to do that kind of thing today because of DNA and traces, evidence, and all the things that we know about in science now. But he knew that there was a monster inside of him, and he drank because of it. Is that true? I don't know. He's usually portrayed as a very cold, calculating, manipulative, and charming man, and he was that as well. So there was an interview I read with somebody who interviewed Ted Bundy while he was in prison. That's what she did. And she was a psychologist or psychiatrist. I mean, that's why he agreed to the interview. And she thought she was impervious to psychopaths. And she went in and interviewed him. And when she came out, she said, "He made me feel pretty."
Oh, my.
And that's creepy.
Yeah.
When
she knew, really creepy.
And she completely knew who he was and what he was. Wow.
Yep. It's just crazy.
That's very interesting when you get right down to it, that, that someone could do that.
Now,
yeah, and then you could be know what he did, sitting across from him, knowing what he did, and it still happened.
Yeah, that's what crazy. I mean. It's just, oh, getting me creeps.
So you see, that's the fascination with serial killers there.
Now, Millicent and her husband get into the killing business kind of by accident. They found it thrilling. Do you think that could actually happen? That, somebody doesn't really intend to do this, but then it happens and they like it?
Well, would rather think it would happen like that rather than a couple sitting around thinking, "Hey, let's go kill somebody and see if we like it." I think it almost has to happen as an accident, and then you realize how thrilled you were by it and how exciting it was, and then you think about doing it again. And I think that is the more actually the more plausible route rather than someone actually having a coherent conversation about going out and killing somebody just to see what it's like. That's a little scary.
That's true. That's true. But it's also, I mean, probably this is why it's more powerful in a book to do this, but the idea that, well, maybe, you know, that could happen to anybody, you know, that they could accidentally kill somebody and then decide that they liked it.
Right.
Which it makes it even creepier.
Exactly. And when you do, I think everybody knows, when you do a bad thing, it's easier the second time. It's hard to tell that first lie, but the second and the third and the fourth come a lot easier. So it's sort of getting over when that first one. And so, which is why in the book it's accidental. It just happened.
Yeah. I mean, accidental, but accidental in one sense, but in another sense, the reasons behind it were, I don't want to give too much away, but you know,
right.
one of the characters really had a lot to do with it occurring. And sure. I won't say which
sure.
one.
Yeah, sure, exactly.
I'm curious as to how you decided to use the other serial killer coming back to the area, using that as a ploy.
I actually was thinking about the old serial killers, the ones from the 70s, like a Ted Bundy or a John Wayne Gacy, and how they communicated so much with the police and with the press, almost like they wanted recognition. The Zodiac killer used to write letters to the newspaper, I think it was in San Francisco. And I was thinking about that old, the things that they can't, nobody can do today because of science. So I wanted to sort of have them be able to blame it on someone, because when too many girls go missing, somebody starts asking questions. So they had mm-hmm. to provide an answer for it, so that nobody would ever look at them. So conveniently enough, this town used to have one of those old serial killers from 20 years ago or something who disappeared. Yeah. And so why not revive him?
Right. Yeah. And they almost got away with it.
So close.
So close. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Samantha Downing, author of My Lovely Wife. Let's talk a little bit more about the success that this book has had. So not only did it, once you got an agent, which happened almost fortuitously, they were able to sell the book in 48 hours. How did that happen?
Yes, she gave it to Jen Monroe, who is now my editor at Berkeley. She gave it to Jen on a 48-hour exclusive, meaning no one else would see it until Jen decided if she wanted to buy it. And then she bought it, and she read it, overnight, basically, and I guess had other people in the office read it. I'm not sure the whole process, but in any case, it was a two-book deal. So I have another one coming out now. Not now, but I'm in editing for the second one. And next year, another one will come out. And it's been great. Jen is a fabulous editor. And we all make a great team. And it's fabulous that it's all women. My publicist is a woman. My marketing team is a woman. Are women. So it's a bunch of really smart, really capable, kick-butt women working on this book.
Good.
With a woman protagonist, in a sense, in the book. I don't know if you call her a protagonist or not. Antagonist?
Right. Well, it might change from page to page. I don't know.
right. And the book has been sold into other countries as well, I understand.
Yes, I think we're into, it's sold into 25 countries now.
Wow.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Wow. And it is out in the UK. The hardcover actually just came out this past week, and it's out in ebook as well in the UK. And it was actually it was at number one on Amazon in the UK.
The first week it came out. That's
the second week. I think it hit number one.
Second week. That's
no. I'm sorry. They do things a little differently. The ebook came out there first.
Okay.
So the ebook was number one.
Wonderful. Wow. Yeah. This must. I mean, how does this all feel to you? Is it kind of surreal?
It's totally surreal. It's bizarre, and my mom thinks it's completely bizarre, and she's like, I don't even know you. How did this even happen?
Well, what does your mom think of the book?
She actually loves the book because she reads thrillers.
Really?
Everybody in my family reads thrillers, so she loved it. And,
so she wasn't disturbed by how disturbing
no.
this is and how...
No, I
so
guess
you're
we're
just
a disturbing
normal
family.
Person.
No, yes.
Well, it's interesting that not only in the United States are people interested in thrillers, but all over the world if you sold to all these other countries.
Yes,
you know.
Yes, yeah,
that's
thrillers.
Interesting, I think.
Everybody loves a good yes. Everybody loves a good serial killer. Apparently.
So you mentioned it's a two-book deal, and how far along are you on the second book?
It is written. I'm in the editing process now, so I've been working on edits, and it'll come out in 2020. I don't have a date, but it'll be sometime in the spring, from what I understand.
And when did the book come out in My Lovely Wife? When did it come out in the U.S.?
March 26th.
Okay, so this is all very recent, and
yeah.
you've been getting an incredible amount of attention. Are you on book tour now?
Yeah, I am. I do have a day job, so I've been there, you know, gone for a day and then back and gone for a day. I will be actually this next week. I'm in Wisconsin for work, and I will be at the Sheboygan Falls Memorial Library in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. That's on Tuesday, and the following week, actually on Friday, the 17th of May, I am with Liv Constantine. They are amazing. They wrote The Last Mrs. Parrish, and their new book, The Last Time I Saw You, is coming out next week. I will be with them at Murder by the Book in Houston, Texas.
And you live in New Orleans? Is that home?
I live in New Orleans, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
How long have you been
and
there?
And the week after... Oh, I have been here... Well, I'm from California, and I have been but living here all of my adult life. I moved
wow.
here after college.
Wow. Okay, so go on the week after. Where are you going?
Oh, the week
next?
After that, I'll be at up near Chicago at Anderson's in LaGrange on May 22nd.
Wow, and can I ask you what your day job is?
I actually work for a manufacturing company, so I work in administration basically. I'm the corporate secretary, and I do some project management.
Oh, cool. Cool. Well, I'm in manufacturing too, so we have that.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's another thing that sometimes people don't expect women to be doing.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's definitely a male-dominated field.
Right, right. Have you met any of the big names in the thriller? Well, you said you're going to be with Liv Constantine. But any of the other big names in the thriller world?
Only a few. Just recently, we had a literary festival here in New Orleans, and I was on a panel with Alifair Burke, who writes thrillers, and her father is James Lee Burke. And she's written, I don't know, 20-something books or something. And then I was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I was with Nick Petrie, who writes a great thriller series with sort of a Lee Child, Jack Reacher type of character.
Oh, great.
So for right now, just a few.
We interviewed E.A. Amar a couple weeks ago. I don't think it's been on the air yet, but he's on the board of a thriller organization. I'm trying to remember what it's called.
Is that the ITW? International Thriller Writers
it might
of America
be.
Or something?
Yeah, yes, okay. ITW, that's it, yeah. Yeah. So apparently this is like a real club you've joined here in Thriller
apparently.
Writers.
I will. Actually, the ITW has an annual, the Thriller Fest. It's up in New York in July, and I do plan to go to that. I think all thriller writers go to that, so that'll be fun.
Yeah, he also runs this thing in D.C. called Noir at the Bar. It's a like a reading. They write short story crime, noir crime fiction that they have readings at a bar, which sounded kind of fun.
Yeah, I'm surprised they don't have that in New Orleans. We have a lot of bars.
Yeah, and you probably have a lot of thriller writers down there, suspense writers.
New Orleans seems like
it would be a good, what would you say, a good locale to set something in. Have you set any of your books in New Orleans?
I haven't yet. New Orleans is actually a little complicated that way because when people who haven't been here think of New Orleans, you think of the standard French Quarter, Mardi Gras, that gumbo, the very voodoo, the very most famous parts of New Orleans. But locals don't really do any of that. So the local side of New Orleans is very different than the visitor side of New Orleans. So it's kind of like if you're writing a book that people outside of New Orleans are going to read, you want to include what they know about, but then the locals will hate you because then you're just being very, very, you're not really portraying the real New Orleans. So it's a very complicated city to try to write in. And I'm not even a native. I'm a local, but I'm not a native. So I kind of, I stay away from it.
Oh, that makes sense. That makes sense. So is the book that you're editing now, can you tell us anything about it?
Just that it's another thriller, and I hope it's just as disturbing as the last one.
And are you going to continue writing in the thriller vein? Is that kind of where you found your home?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I enjoy it.
And it works, obviously, and you're good at it, obviously.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. I'm glad so many people like the book.
Are there any of the books that you wrote before My Lovely Wife that you would kind of pull out of the drawer, polish off, and see about publishing now that you've cracked the publishing world?
No. The way I look at it is my first published book, I start from there and keep moving forward. I believe what I strive to do is write better each time. So I don't want to go back and I don't want to use the stuff that was like the training grounds for me. I want the next book to be better than the last and the one after that to be better than the last. And I want to keep moving forward in my writing and how I tell a story.
That's probably very wise because, I know that John Grisham, after he became famous, they went back and republished one of his first books that had been rejected and it got published later. And I don't remember whether it was as good as the later ones or not, but I think maybe it wasn't, that it didn't, didn't quite ring quite as true to people. But also I'm reminded of the classic story about Ernest Hemingway and his wife, Hadley Hemingway, was bringing him all of his manuscripts on a train, and she left them in a suitcase under the seat of her train, got off to get a snack, or when it walked away to get a snack, I think went onto the platform, came back, and they were all gone. And of course, this was before the day of copy machines and computers or anything. And so for most of those manuscripts, it was the only copy that he had. And he was devastated by the loss of all this work, and it probably was the beginning of the end of their marriage. But some experts think that having lost all that work and having to start again with all of that experience and the skills that he had gained from writing made him so much a better writer, and really he might not have had the success that he did ended up having if that had not happened.
Interesting. Yeah. And then it may be true. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would not have wanted to have to tell him that, though.
No kidding. No kidding.
Wow.
I mean, just when you think about that, I'm old enough to remember when getting a copy of something was not that easy to do. And when, you know, if you wanted to submit something, you had to have it all printed out, and you went to make a copy at the copy store. You know, you typed it up, and then you went to the copy shop to get a copy made. Or even before that, of course, you didn't even have that option. You had to hire somebody to retype it for you, usually, unless you had good typing skills and wanted to do it yourself. In some ways, it's so much easier to write now.
And I think to submit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I think there's a whole generation, multiple generations that are now can become self-published writers or traditionally published writers or whatever because of computers, and because you don't have to buy the paper and you don't have to buy the ink ribbons and you don't have to buy the little whiteout that you used to have to buy with typewriters. I mean, it's all right there on a I can't imagine what it would be like to have to put it in paper by paper by page by page by page and then have it copied and then mail it off to a publisher. I mean, that alone probably discouraged all kinds of people.
Absolutely. And of course, the downside of that is now there really are so many books out there that it can be very difficult for any one book to get attention and to get lasting attention in particular.
Mm-hmm.
So the amount of attention that your book has received is kind of like winning the lottery.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. You feel kind of like it's not happening to you. Like you're kind of like, obviously this isn't my life. I'm just watching somebody else live it.
I bet. And it's, you know, does there come a point when you realize that this is real and it's going to continue and, hey, I can quit my day job? I know you probably don't want to say
comes.
That.
No, I mean, I'll let you know if that moment comes, but at some point I hope it feels real, but right now I'm okay. I'm just kind of riding the wave of this launch process since it's all new to me and you only get to go through it the first time once. So
that's
I'm just
true.
Trying to do everything they tell me to do and go everywhere they tell me to go and do what I'm supposed to do since I don't know the process.
And what things about the process have surprised you?
Well, what's interesting about the publishing world is how long it takes to publish a book. This book was first bought in the summer of 2017, and we're almost to the summer of 2019. So in a world where everything moves so fast, it's incredible how long it takes to get a book published and to go through the editing, the copy editing, they design the cover, they have to get the prints out and the galleys out. And I mean, it's a huge, long process. And I don't think it's gotten any shorter over the years. I think the process is the process and that's just how it works. But I wasn't prepared for that. And it feels like there's a lot of times when nothing's happening, but all this stuff is happening behind the scenes and you're just not in the publisher's office to see it.
Mm. Now, do you have any input into the cover?
They sent me a couple of covers to say which one I liked best, and the other cover was very different and did not have a knife on the cover, but this one was so unique and not like anything I had seen about it. In fact, my editor and my agent and me all picked this cover. It was unanimous that this had to be the cover. So
that's good.
It wasn't and sales and whoever else gets a say in what happens in the publishing world. I think everybody just loved it because of how creepy it is and how different it is. It's just one of those ones that catches your eye when you see it in a bookstore.
That is true. And one thing I've noticed, you know, we get a lot of books, and we get both conventionally published, you know, mainstream traditional publishers, indie publishers, and self-published books. And I can almost always tell right away if a book has been self-published by the look and the feel of the book. Even if they had a professional cover designer, which is a good first start. If you're going to self-publish a book, get a professional cover designer if you can possibly afford it, because you know, can't judge a book by a cover, but we all do. And so that would be a piece of advice I would give. But the other thing is, and I just realized this recently, the color and the weight of the paper also is a tell. And if you don't want your book to look self-published, go out and look at the books and see what the weight in the, and I don't, you know, maybe with self-publishing, maybe the, you know, the publishing on demand, maybe you can't get the paper that they use for print runs. That's, you know, I don't know, but if you can, you should try to, if you're going to self-publish.
Say often on traditionally published, you also see the raised lettering or the embossing or things that it's not always just a smooth cover. I know on this one for My Lovely Wife, the knife is foiled, so it actually is reflective when you move it. And so I don't, those kind of things are expensive and unique.
Right, and probably very, very difficult to do on a self-published book. Did you ever consider self-publishing?
No, I didn't. I knew that it would take, self-publishing to me is, you have to either learn all of the other disciplines, the marketing, the social media, the publicity, the book design, the editing. You either have to hire everybody to do that or learn how, at the very least, you learn, have to learn how to promote yourself because nobody else is going to do it for you, or hire a publicist. And again, it just went back to my love was just the writing. So it got to the point where that's what I didn't care if anybody else saw it. I wasn't doing it so other people could read it. I did it because it's like people that go home at night and play a musical instrument, or they cook, or they garden, and it's just their thing, and it's just what they love to do, and writing just happened to be mine. There's plenty of people that go home and play the guitar and know they're never going to be standing in a concert arena playing it for a million people. So it's just something they do because they love it.
That is probably one of the things that has made you successful as a published author, is that you were writing for yourself.
Yeah, it was never, it didn't matter if anybody else ever read it.
Yeah, and you weren't trying to figure out what the market wanted and then write that. So now, it might be dangerous now that you are a published author to fall into that, to say, okay, well... okay, here, this book is really popular, and maybe I should write something like that. But do you have trouble coming up with new plot and character ideas?
No, I actually just start with a character idea in my head, and I write the first chapter, and I don't plot, I don't outline, I don't know what the end is going to be. I've tried to do that before, and the books, they come out, especially for a thriller, it comes out very telegraphed and very predictable, because as I write it, I already know what's going to happen. So somehow that gets into my writing. When I'm writing and I don't know what's going to happen next, and I write it chapter by chapter, idea by idea, it comes out much better. So in my eyes and in my editor's eyes, there's just something not right about it. And I guess because that's the way I've always done it, to do it by outline now is like retraining myself. And it's just better if I don't know what's going to happen.
So you really didn't know. I mean, My Lovely Wife has a really interesting twist in it. Did you really not know that that was going to be the case?
No, I didn't.
Oh, my gosh. No. That's even more impressive.
I mean, the book does go through revisions, of course, to make sure all the plot points are, you know, in sync with each other and nothing is left dangling. But no, because for me, I'm not a chess player. I can't think 200 moves in advance. I'm just step by step. One idea leads to the next idea leads to the next idea, and then I'll think, oh, I see, I can tie this into what happened before. And then it starts to, the deeper I get into it, the more it starts to come together in my head.
Oh, wow. That's really fascinating. And I wish we had more time to get into that, but it looks like we're about out of time now. Oh, wow.
Okay.
So, yeah. Mom, do you have any final words for us today?
I do, actually. You know, this. Well, I don't want to be a spoiler either, but for the ending, there's an mm-hmm. African proverb that says, "However long the night, the dawn will break."
And that's very mm-hmm. suitable. Thank you so mm-hmm. much for being with us here today, Samantha.
Thank you. This was great.
It certainly was. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.